Friday mornings are for what? Coffee and contemplation. That's right. Welcome in. It's Outkick the Culture. I'm Jason Martin, your host on Twitter at JMartOutkick. Follow me there. Let me know what you think of me, of the show, of whatever you'd like. My DMs are wide open, so let it fly. You can also email me at jmartclone@gmail.com. Last week, we talked all about Mindhunter. A lot of you wrote to me, enjoyed that conversation. Glad you did, first of all. And then some that did not know, actually, that that show was based on truth and was based on actual people. So that's cool. I'm glad I was able to kind of inform you a little bit about John Douglas and the crew and what is real behind this Mindhunter series that has taken over our lives over the last few weeks. But our lives have changed again, ladies and gentlemen. Pop culture wins almost as much as sex in this world. Stranger Things is back. Stranger Things, which hit in 2016 and was undeniably one of the biggest cultural touchstones of the year by any classification, is back. July 15th, 2016 is when it hit. It hit during the summer. This one hits the week of Halloween, and actually the second season begins just about exactly where we are. I think it's the 24th, is if my note is right, October 24th. About a year after, not quite a year after the events, concluding events of the first season. So we're going to talk Stranger Things today, and that's kind of going to be it. I'm not sure how long this is going to go because we can talk about season one, but I can't talk to you about season two and feel good about it. Even though I've seen it all, you have not. So we're going to have to wait and do that next week. I also did that in my review. I made sure even in the title to write spoiler-free so people would feel okay to go and read it. And in that piece, and it was actually revealed on the radio show, starting on Monday, episode by episode, one by day, or one each day, I'm going to lay out one of my real recaps where we do get into the spoilers, and you can read those as you go through the series. I did not do season one. I watched it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I've now rewatched it, but I did not review it except in my top 10 at the end of the year where it was in the honorable mention category. I might, depending on interest level and how many people end up reading these season two recaps, which I expect is going to be a pretty good number, based on just the sheer volume of people that care about this show and the people that are starting to read my stuff. And thank you so much. I'm blessed beyond measure for anybody that does take the time to read me, and hopefully you enjoy and get something out of what I provide for you. But if there's interest, I'll go back and do episode by episode of season one as well, or at least a chunk, maybe one and two, and then three and four, and five and six, and seven and eight. There's nine episodes in season two. The only thing that I can really tell you about season two is that it's not a letdown if you liked season one. I think I had more fun watching season two than season one. I enjoyed season one tremendously. It was imperfect, and so was season two, especially early. There are a few decisions made, one big creative decision that I was just like, what on earth were they thinking on this? And it worries you a little bit, but you just keep watching. And by the end, it's not that that decision works, but the end is strong. The series, the season, ends on a really, really high point. So that's a major positive as you go into this experience, knowing that this nine-hour binge that you're about to undertake is worth it in the end, just like season one was. The reason Stranger Things worked, and it's created by the Duffer Brothers, who are these two guys out of Durham, North Carolina, that loved 80s movies and loved Steven Spielberg and loved George Lucas and loved John Carpenter and loved people like that. They were men after my own heart, quite frankly, because I did the same. I grew up watching The Goonies. I grew up watching E.T., The Thing, all of the things that you see within the realm of Stranger Things. Another thing, you think about The Goonies, even though The Goonies wasn't necessarily a supernatural film in any respect, it wasn't really a sci-fi film, it was still kind of a coming-of-age movie, but it was more just about a group of kids, likable kids, undertaking a quest for a purpose. In their case, it was more economic-based, trying to help out their community, help out their houses, help out their families. They were in a real bad spot at that point, so they ended up trying to look for treasure in the end. But in Stranger Things, they're trying to find a friend, Will Byers, that goes just missing, just disappears off the face of the planet, and then they find out about all the other things that are going on in Hawkins, Indiana that are not really above board and, in fact, are below the tightrope. And if you've seen the episodes and seen the show, you know what I mean by that analogy, the flea and the acrobat, as you will. But you see the Goonies in this, and you see some E.T. with the 11 character and how she's hidden and even how she's on the bike with Will, even though she's not in the basket in the front. She's behind it. Not Will, pardon me, with Mike. She's not in the basket in the front. She's behind him, sitting behind him on the bike. But there's still a lot of that E.T. character where they're trying to protect her from various people, even from the parents in the household. But there's also the thing with the actual Demogorgon, which comes straight off a board game board of Dungeons & Dragons, which is another interesting way that the Duffer Brothers pay homage to the 80s. This entire thing is an homage, an homage to 80s culture, to 80s pop culture, to movies, to games, to television, to all of these things. Sometimes it's misseen, and they think everybody thinks, and there are people that have never watched it that assume it's just a horror show, and it's absolutely not. The reason it works is because of the nostalgia effect first, I think. And then because there's chemistry between those young actors who you just really like, Dustin in particular, Gatton Matazzaro, I absolutely love that kid. He looks like a kid that you'd want to hang out with. Lucas is an awesome kid. Mike Wheeler, Finn Wolfhard, who's had quite a year, quite a last 2 years, as a matter of fact, as being as young as he is, he's now done 2 seasons of Stranger Things, and he was also in a key role in It, which was obviously an enormous hit at the box office this year. And I wrote in my review that Finn Wolfhard, who plays Mike Wheeler, I don't know that I could ever see him in something that's not set 30 years ago, because he looks like he's from the 80s. His hair, his face, all of it, he looks retro. Dustin kind of looks retro too, but Mike Wheeler looks extremely retro. Finn Wolfhard, Frog Face, as the bullies call him there in the first season, that dude looks like he's from 35 years ago. It's perfect. Like, it works so beautifully, 35, 30 years ago, wherever you want to be. But, I mean, anytime he's playing something from the past, like he did in It, which was set, of course, decades ago, and with Stranger Things, which is set decades ago, he looks the part, and he's good in the role. He's a little annoying in the first season, but it's okay. He's also got a good heart, and he's working for the right things. So the chemistry of the kids works. And, you know, child actors can be a double-edged sword. It can be really good if it works, and it can be really awful if it doesn't. If it's awful, it can destroy a property. But if it's good, it works. When we talked about It on this podcast about a month ago, or maybe a little, it's probably, I guess, closer to 2 months ago now, as time just rolls in this world, ladies and gentlemen, we talked about how the child actors kind of made that film because they had to. They had so much screen time, and if they sucked, that film was going to be terrible. And they didn't. They were awfully good, quite frankly. Same thing you can say about some of the shows that are on TV now, like Fresh Off the Boat. Fresh Off the Boat, as good as Randall Park and Constance Wu and the adults are on that show, Paul Scheer and everybody that's even the bit performers on that show, the kids are amazing on that show. Eddie and his crew are right there with the Stranger Things kids. And then, of course, Eddie's brothers as well. Everything about, like, the child acting and even the adolescent and those that are getting in their teenage years acting on that show is just really good. It works. It's imperfect, but it's good because of the childlike wonder that you get from that. And sometimes the things that look cheesy, if an adult said it, work when a smaller kid says it. Like, there are some really heavy-handed lines in the first season of Stranger Things, things that would make you roll your eyes, except Dustin and Lucas and Mike and, you know, that crop of people are saying it and it works. Whereas if Hopper was saying it, or if Joyce was saying it, or, good Lord, Mike's father, who's just a complete loser and is designed to be a complete loser, as 80s fathers often were, at least early in these pictures. Remember the original George McFly in Back to the Future before Marty went back in time in the DeLorean to 1955 and turned his dad into a pimp, basically. That George McFly, very similar to me, to the sad sack that happens to be married to the lovely and talented Cara Buono, who is back yet again in season 2 to play Mike's mom. It doesn't work when adults say this stuff, but when kids do, it sometimes has this charm to it, and it works where it would not with an older crowd. That's why, to me, the kids were much more impressive, especially early in the first season, than the teenage actors. Like Natalia Dyer, who plays Nancy Wheeler, for example. She delivered lines early that just did not sound authentic. As did Shannon Purser, as a matter of fact, who plays Barb and boy Barb and that story and that kind of, you know, I don't think with the way they dropped Barb at the end of the first season and people stopped caring about that portion of things, and how everybody, once they got Will back, the rage on the internet and even the SNL skit and Jimmy Fallon and all of that stuff, they took shots, they took jokes, they made it a running joke about Barb and about how they just left her out of the equation. I don't know that Stranger Things would have had quite as much of an impact without that Barb situation, because that kept it alive and it became something that even people that hadn't watched the show heard about and then were intrigued by. And Shannon Purser, who played the role and got an Emmy nomination because of the fervor surrounding the Barb storyline more so than anything else, her lines in the early stages of the first season, and I do think you should go back and watch the first season, maybe not before you watch two. You want to watch two now. It's good. But you will be stunned at how much you've forgotten about the first season. You'll remember the big moments, but there are even some fairly big moments that I did not remember until I went back and rewatched it. So I'm really glad I did. Plus, it's just a lot of fun to watch. But Shannon Purser, in those first couple of episodes, delivering this bad dialogue, this very cheesy dialogue, but her supposed to be sort of a smart teenage character, sounds terrible. It sounds so artificial and wrong. And then you're just like, man, is she just a terrible actress? Well, the answer is no. But if the same stuff had been being said by Millie Bobby Brown's 11 or somebody of her age, for example, it would have worked. So I think that that works to Stranger Things' benefit because the kids are pretty good. And they're good in a way kids need to be, which is imperfect enough to still look like and feel like children. Which is the same thing you get from It. It's the same thing you get from Fresh Off the Boat. It's the same thing you get from all these people. These are all talented folks and talented young people, but they're still young people, and they still have these idiosyncrasies that plays well to just blemishes in performances. Like Winona Ryder is fantastic as Joyce, and the best performance on the show to me is David Harbour, who was also nominated for an Emmy this year for Hopper, who's my favorite character on the show. Like, they're awesome, and Matthew Modine is good in his creepy Dr. Brenner role. And look, I mean, all the adults are very good. But this show really does not succeed without those kids being charming and being people you want to see on screen and want to see succeed and want to see hang out. And that's what you get from Stranger Things. And Stranger Things 2 does a good job of keeping that alive. But it's amazing what Stranger Things actually became. When you first saw it pop up on Netflix last spring and you saw the trailer and you didn't know what to expect, but there have been moments where you've seen previews for Netflix shows and you get excited because it's Netflix, and then you realize, look, they put out a lot of stuff and a lot of it's good, but there's also the Santa Clarita Diet waiting out there for you to find. You know, there's some stuff out there that didn't work. There's Iron Fist hanging out there for you to find. There's a lot of good, but there's also a lot of stuff that's worth passing on. And I think when I first knew anything about Stranger Things coming out, when I first read about it, I prayed that it would be good because I thought it was a really cool idea. And I wanted to go back to the 80s. The Goldbergs has done a good job of making me nostalgic for the stuff that I grew up on, the movies that I used to go to the video store and rent. And actually, this week on the Goldbergs, we saw an instance about how important the video store used to be. And boy, did it ever. I remember Sharon's videotapes in Martinsville, Virginia, where I used to grow up. I would go there and rent Nintendo games and rent movies. And then there was obviously a bunch of other places that we would go to as well, but Sharon's is the one that I used to beg my dad to take me to on weekends. And I would go there and I'd rent Castlevania II, Simon's Quest, or Ikari Warriors, or whatever the case may be there. And then I would rent films. And this was a time when I couldn't go online and figure out what these things were about. I had to look at the box, and sometimes if the artwork caught my eye, I would rent Romancing the Stone, or I would, you know, see if Dad would be cool if we got meatballs or whatever it might be. And that kind of nostalgia is what Stranger Things trades in. I don't know that this is true across the board, but if you wanted to buy the first season of Stranger Things, which, look, if you have Netflix, I don't know exactly what the market is here, but this would be one I would consider just for the extras and things like that. But the Target exclusive packaging, at least, and like I said, this could be across the board, but I've seen it at Target. It's a Blu-ray, but it's like a clamshell size, and it looks like a VHS that's, you know, been bent here and there. Like, you can see the wear on the jacket around the tape, but it's obviously not a tape. It's just the box, the packaging surrounding the Blu-ray. and it just kind of takes you back to a different time. And when you're looking at 2017 and some of the problems in the world, it doesn't stink to go back and think about 1980s childhood, at least for me. 1984, around the time where Stranger Things was taking place, 1983, 1984, I was 5-6 years old, so these kids were older than me. I saw the Goonies pretty close after it came out. Actually, you know what? I saw the Goonies in the theater. But I was telling a story on OutKick earlier this morning as I'm recording this on Friday as the show has just released, and I've just posted my review. If you missed that, you can go to OutKick.com and find it. Is I remember in 1988 taking a vacation to Atlanta with my parents. Went and saw a Braves game, saw Andre Dawson hit a foul ball that came dangerously close to where we were down the first baseline. It was a Braves-Cubs game. One day, I wanted to go see movies because I love movies and wanted to go to movies all the time. I went and saw Police Academy 5, Assignment Miami Beach. Made my mom take me to that like 4 or 5 different times because I absolutely loved it. I was a big Police Academy fan. Maybe we'll talk about that one day on this show, about how much I used to watch. You know, I taped them off TV because nobody bought videotapes back in the day. They were like $100. You remember that? Back when, like, you can go to Best Buy now if you want to, and you can buy a DVD for $9.99 or $15 or $20, depending on release date and extras and things like that. But there was a time when, like, if you wanted to buy a tape and you went into a video store, if you went into a Blockbuster Video or something like that, you're like, you know, I want to own a copy of this. Before they used to sell their pre-owned stuff, their pre-rented stuff for $9.99, they could bring out a catalog and you could actually look up, you know, whatever it was that you wanted to buy and they could order it for you. And the tape price would be like $98.50. And it was nothing special. It was just these films, you actually went to the theater to see all this stuff. I stood in line for hours, hours in 1989 with my friends on a birthday. It was part of somebody's birthday party, as a matter of fact, to watch Batman on the first night. The original Batman, the Michael Keaton Batman, the Tim Burton Batman. Stood in line. I remember the Reeves Theater, again in Martinsville, Virginia. That line went around the theater, curved around the block. I mean, it probably went close to a mile because the entire town went to it. There wasn't as much going on. There wasn't as much competition for the entertainment dollar. There were a few channels that didn't come in all that well outside of the networks. It was a Friday night, so there wasn't going to be much on TV anyway, unless you were older. So Batman's coming out. Batman? Are you kidding me? We're all going to Batman. And I remember we got into Batman, and we did watch it as part of that birthday celebration. The seats were not all that great. But the nostalgia of that, just the stuff that I just recalled, you know, some of my memories, I'm sure, are skewed, or maybe I remember things that didn't happen exactly like that. The stuff that I've told you just now about the Reeves Theater and about Sharon's videos, it was Sharon's something. It wasn't videos. It was Sharon's something and something, I think, movies and games or whatever it was. Sharon's is where I always went. Those stories are dead true. So when I watch Stranger Things, I see my childhood. I see so much of it. I see the dumb shirts that I used to wear. In Stranger Things 2, in the first episode, Dustin is wearing this purple hoodie with a brontosaurus skeleton on it from the Minnesota Science Museum. I had friends that would have owned that. And I guarantee you, there will be hipster stores. You will go into a Hot Topic, and that will be available. I would be stunned if ThinkGeek or someplace like that does not make that into a hoodie. It's not like as soon as I saw it, I said, well, that thing would sell. That thing would absolutely sell. And if you've seen the Hawkins Middle School AV Club shirts and things like that, Stranger Things sells. So I do expect that you'll see that, not to mention other things. But the nostalgia has worked so well. So outside of just the kids and Hopper and Joyce and obviously Jonathan and Nancy and Steve, who Steve you thought was going to be just a complete douche. And it turns out kind of was, but he actually had a soul and he found that soul. So when you see him in season 2, you don't despise the very sight of him, which is a positive, even though you're still probably Team Jonathan in that situation. Callahan, Officer Callahan, who's just sort of a bit character in the first season. He just pops up here and there and says things that are just completely ridiculous. I love that character. He made me laugh more than anybody else in the show. John Paul Reynolds, he just says stuff that people shouldn't say. Hideous stuff, like, and not even necessarily offensive, but just like, God, you put your foot in your mouth every time you open it. Callahan was just a joy. in that first season. You did get some good one-liners in the first season. And my favorite line by far in the history of the show remains the one that I opened this podcast with today. Morning is for coffee and contemplation. Coffee and contemplation. Then he walks into his office and Joyce is there waiting for him. If you want another good line, Karen, thank you for the casserole, but I need you to leave. Again, if you're listening to this, I assume you've already watched the first season of Stranger Things. If not, then you really like my voice. And if you're an attractive female, please reach out at @jmartoutkick. You've got the ex-husband, Joyce's ex-husband, Lonnie, who does what all scumbag ex-husbands in the 80s did, show up for the wrong reasons. He wanted the money from Will's death. He wanted to try and weasel back in so that he could cash in. He was a bad guy, ends up getting knocked right on back out. And then you've got, look, Hopper in season two is a hero. He's a guy that you root for. You were rooting for him most of season one. When you first met Hopper, and this is one of the things that where Stranger Things got me, is early I thought Hopper was just going to be a drunk and somebody we weren't going to like. And then he turns out to be actually legitimately trying to find this kid, do his job, be there for Joyce, be there for Jonathan, do everything properly, even when it meant breaking the rules, breaking the law, to try and get to the truth. So in season two, you're already rooting for this guy. And in season two, you meet a foil for him, played by Sean Astin, which is perfect, considering the 80s nostalgia. Always cool. Like the Goldbergs this week, I've already mentioned that a couple of times, because it just fits when you're talking about Stranger Things in the 80s to mention the Goldbergs. This week's episode of The Goldbergs was directed by Leah Thompson, and you saw her in the kind of the epilogue there at the end of the episode, the postscript where they showed the 100-episode celebration where she was a part of it. And they even did a tribute to Leah Thompson within the episode where you had Barry's friends dressed as Biff's 1955 cronies at the Halloween dance at the high school. And then you had, and you even had the sister dressed up as Leah Thompson from Back to the Future as the mom from 1955. So there's just a good pull there. So Sean Astin shows up pretty much right out of the gates in season two. He's within the first 20 minutes at least. And you find out his role immediately. And he's basically a foil for Hopper. And everything that you like about Hopper, you're going to dislike about Sean Astin's character. And this is so 1980s, it's ridiculous. In terms of structure and how this is laid out. This is done because the Duffer Brothers love the 80s and understand how to create a villain that isn't necessarily doing anything wrong. He's just lame. Like all the things that are kind of cool about Hopper, it's the exact opposite with the Sean Astin character. And Sean Astin's kind of perfect to play it because, well, let's be serious, since some of the earlier films that he did, he's been portrayed this way. Remember the character he played in 24 and how annoying that guy was? That's kind of what he's done in his later years. This ain't the Rudy Sean Astin, you know? This is certainly not the Goonies Sean Astin. Him playing kind of a loser is a solid choice by the Stranger Things casting people. But season one took us from Will's disappearance to Eleven's arrival to what she was and who she was and potentially actually her real name and her real mother and her abilities and these kids that didn't really know what to make of her, then kind of became intoxicated by her, then really did see her as a friend, then thought she betrayed them and then came back. And then, of course, she played the pivotal role in erasing the Demogorgon and saving at least some of the lives, although some of the people that died at the end of season one kind of needed to for the sake of the story. This was a show where after you watched it, you would be surprised if it wasn't going to come back. It didn't get an immediate announcement, but it came relatively quickly. The level of interest was just too much for them not to have wanted to do it again and for Netflix not to have wanted them to do it again. But had there not been a season two, season one was a fully realized experience where if we had just gotten those 8 episodes and that would have been the end, even with the open-ended deal, even with the epilogue and potential new monsters and all the stuff that we saw there in that final couple of minutes of the first season, if that had been it, we could have just, you know, opened our imagination to, well, it didn't end, did it? And then you just move on. But I'm glad it's back and you're going to be glad it's back because everything that you liked about it originally is just a little bit more refined now. One of the problems with sequels is that so often they try to ramp up everything instead of refining and really focusing on what made the first thing work. There are bands that can do this and bands that can't. Music acts that every album, they want to sound different. This album's rock. Then they're going to go a little bit folksy. Then they're going to bring out electronica. Then they're going to do all these different things. And some diehard fans will stick by them. And if they're good enough, most will, because they're just great musicians. There are also bands that try to change their style because they don't want to get typecast or don't want to sound the same and everything, and they lose half their audience. They might pick up some new fans, but they lose a lot of the originals. And I think that that's apropos, and I think it's comparable to sequels, in that sequels try to take everything that was done effectively in the first film, ramp that thing up to the 9,000th power, do everything bigger and better, add a bunch of characters, maybe add some celebrities, whatever it is, to try and trump what was done initially, as opposed to realizing what worked and providing more of that, but with enough new surrounding it that it still feels like a unique experience. The Matrix was a beautiful film, one of my favorite films of all time. The first time I saw it, it absolutely blew me away. Matrix Reloaded, I liked. I was just well in on that trilogy. I liked Reloaded and Revolutions, sue me. Don't at me on Twitter. Nah, go ahead and at me. It's at JMartOutKick. I liked them all. I saw the first film and the third film as Christian analogies in some respects. Reloaded had some very strange things, like the conversation with the architect that no one will ever understand. But remember how you felt before Reloaded came out, and then when you walked out of that theater and talked to other people around you. Remember Spider-Man 3 and how you felt when you walked out of there. Remember Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and how you felt when you walked out of that theater. Sequels get it wrong way more than they get it right. So Stranger Things, because it had so much interest, the expectations were high, that meant the pressure was high, and it's so easy to then go too far over the top and lose what made it work in the first place. That's not the case in season two. While there are mistakes made creatively, most of it works, and it still feels very much like the first season did. And that's what you want. We wanted more Stranger Things. We don't want Stranger Things on a mountaintop. It's like, look, you can stay on the mountain that the first film built without leaping off that mountain to try and do something different that fast. Stranger Things is not an anthology series. We know these characters now, which to me made Stranger Things 2 more exciting, just because we don't have to go through this introductory phase anymore. We've seen these kids. We've seen how they interact. We know some things about their personalities. We know the relationships in their lives. Now you can add a few characters like they do with Max or Maxine, who you meet in the first episode of season two. And you can add your Sean Astins and some of these folks. But you still stay true, and you can just kind of get into the meat of things. That's why season two is usually better than season one in almost every television show. Now, when you get to 3 and 4, especially when you get to 4 or beyond, that's when most shows begin to really lose their way, because either the kids have gotten too old, they've run out of all their good ideas, they're retreading, they're taking vacations all over the place, there's a baby involved, whatever it is. But we're in the good spot for Stranger Things. And unless it's changed, the Duffers have said they wanted to do 3 seasons and that's it. So it's really not going to have too much of a chance to lose itself, provided they don't get stupid next season. And I don't think that they're going to. They've done a good job so far of creating a universe that's fun to play around in, fun to watch these people play around in. And they did a lot of cool stuff. I was never the biggest fan of the military side of the first season, the first time I watched it in particular, the Modine scenes and all of that. That seemed very hokey to me. It felt very 1980s to me. It felt like I was playing Life Force, and that's the third Konami video game that I've referenced in this podcast. Not sure why, but it fits. Maybe Contra, I could throw that in there as well. Guess what? That's also a Konami game, so I failed again, so that's 4. But Life Force, really, when you're going into the Upside Down and going into that gate, that portal that ended up killing the first guy that went through, and then, of course, Hopper and everybody rolls through there late in the season. I didn't like that as much. Now, when I rewatched it here recently, that worked a lot better for me. Maybe because I knew what to expect from the show by that point, or maybe just because it fit better. Like, I was just more prepared for that to be part of this 80s nostalgia. My favorite part is watching the kids interact and watching them plan and watching them come to realizations about the acrobat and the flea or the upside down or the magnet and the compass and all of that, because I love watching those four boys in particular interact. And then when they added Millie Bobby Brown and just the conflict that that created and the tension that that sometimes created and the affection that that sometimes created, that to me is when the show was at its best. Those were the most fun scenes to watch. Maybe the best acted scenes were the scenes with Hopper mainly, or Joyce, even though Joyce was hard to watch when she was at her like crazy wit's end with the Christmas lights and the lamps all in Will's room and all those things. And those were about like episodes 2 through 4 before anybody believed her. It makes sense that why she acted that way, but she was a little bit cringeworthy in terms of just being able to watch her. It was tough. I think it was supposed to be tough. We were supposed to feel for her, because we knew she was not nuts and nobody was taking her seriously, and we knew the stakes involved throughout. But you get almost everything that you want from the second season of this show. The first season does homage right. It has its share of humor, but it certainly doesn't rely on that. Season 2, in the first episode, I laughed more than I laughed in probably half of season 1. And by season 2, I mean the first episode of season 2. In the first hour, I probably laughed more in that hour than I did in the first 4.5 of season 1. Which is impressive. And of course, you have a new crop of people to pay attention to on the good and bad side. I mentioned Sean Astin. Another interesting choice, I kind of just threw this out off the top, is Paul Reiser in a very key role. Mad About You, My Two Dads, and now Stranger Things season 2. And that is a strange, pun intended, casting choice. But I think he pulls it off. It's not bad. Like, you see it and you're just like, wow, that's Paul freaking Reiser. Why is this happening? Like, this is weird. It's like it's like Bill Burr popping up in Breaking Bad. Never fit, but then it worked. And here in Stranger Things, I think it works. I think Paul Reiser does a nice job. He actually plays a relatively believable version of the person he's playing. I don't want to tell you what allegiance he is or what he is yet, because you have to experience this show. And that's why this is going to be a shorter episode of this podcast, quite frankly, because I can't talk about season 2 with you yet, except just the few things that I've told you so far. You know, there were a couple of digs at the government last season, like, again, Mike's father with his honey, we have to trust them. This is our government. They're on our sideline. You know, the 80s was all about the Cold War, and that was sort of the weaponizing that they were doing to 11, doing to L, came in response to what they were trying to do with the Russians, and that was sort of how everybody thought that explained why they would be doing what they were doing. And the government was seen in a different light then as well, I think, by most of the public. Plus, if you notice, actually you don't notice, but early in season 2, if you've already seen the first episode or the first half hour, you will have already seen this. But there's Reagan Bush 84 stuff that you'll see in like yards and things like that. So it works on that level as well. Although I don't think it's in Mike's yard, but it is in another yard of a character's family that I'm not going to tell you who the character is, because it's a decent-sized reveal to see where they've headed with this particular part of the story in season 2. But they bring in the Department of Energy and obviously the military, and they use the Hawkins Power and Light van, and you get that great scene in season 1 where L flips the van. You kind of saw it coming, but it was still super effective. All the bigger stuff that they did with L in season 1 was a ton of fun. It was over the top in the way that you would expect an 80s film like that to be over the top. Like, if I saw a van flip like that in Teen Wolf, I would not have batted an eyelash, just like I didn't bat an eyelash when I saw it in Stranger Things. This is a world where everything can be possible. So you can then treat this like more of a sandbox, more of a playground, than you could This Is Us, for example. Everything about it, from the monsters to the Dungeons and Dragons coming to life ideas behind certain portions of it, and even the deer sequence there in the first season, all of it, like everything plays to what I remember growing up. And that's why this show has been as successful as it has. I would love to talk to people that are young, like really talk to younger kids that are like 10 years old that were able to watch the first season. And I don't know that you were old enough if you have seen it and you're 10 years old. And I'm not sure you're listening to this podcast anyway. Maybe your parents are. I would love to know what those people think of Stranger Things, because I think that Stranger Things is best experienced by people around my age. And I turned 39 last week on the 17th. And I was able to grow up during, and I was old enough to really know what was going on by around 85. That's when I begged my mom to take me to Back to the Future after tricking her and telling her, yeah, we'll go see the Black Cauldron. And we drove 30 minutes to the Black Cauldron where Back to the Future was also playing. And I convinced her finally to let me see a PG-13 movie. She was so worried about it. Then we left and she said it was a really good decision, that she was glad that I was able to see it, that it was a good movie. And it still remains one of my all-time favorite films and one that I will fight to the death to defend. I don't think I really have to. Everybody loves Back to the Future. But I grew up in a time where I could appreciate all that was going on. And when I watch Stranger Things, I can appreciate that time. I can appreciate those houses, those carpets, those televisions, the way the schools look, everything, the clothing, even the dialogue, the glasses that Mike's father wears are very reminiscent of the ones my dad wore and the ones that I wore when I started wearing glasses in second grade, because I was blessed with many things, but perfect eyesight was certainly not one of them. Second grade, I was already rocking glasses. Let me tell you, the girls swooned in third grade. When we went to the zoo, they were all over me. If by all over me, you mean not really talking to me, except on a friend level. This was my life. Maybe it's still my life. I don't know. But I would just be curious to talk to 10, 11-year-olds and find out what they really thought of Stranger Things. Like, when they watch it, I'm sure that they probably liked it if they've seen it. But I don't know that you can fully grasp it if you don't have the nostalgia piece. It's like it's a show that is designed to turn adults back into children, where we don't have to think too hard. We get enough drama involved to still satiate the maturity of our sides. We're also able to laugh and just kind of get into this monster story and this thriller and the sci-fi, and remember the films that we used to go to, Flight of the Navigator, or The Goonies, or Explorers, or Project X, or whatever the film might have been for you back in the day. And I just named Project X, which I absolutely hated, the monkey film with Matthew Broderick. I was excited about it until I actually saw it. Even at my age, I was able to tell that one wasn't particularly good. But all of the positive films from the 80s that you still remember so well, even like Midnight Run, which if you haven't seen, you need to watch. Stuff that you remember used to go to movie theaters if you're around my age. One of the best things about going to the movies was when you would walk around in the lobby and see the marquees with the Coming Soon posters. Because again, other than trailers, which at that time were much different than the kind of trailers that we see today, and they didn't come out nearly as far in advance, I don't remember, as they do now. Like, you'll see things 2 and 3 months in advance now. Whereas back in the day, I would remember films, I would see, a trailer for, I don't know, I'm trying to think of one that I have not already mentioned 700 times on this podcast that's not an embarrassment for me to mention. Coneheads. Like, Coneheads was a bigger one, and Coneheads was a little bit later on, but it was still kind of around that same time. Like, you knew Coneheads was coming out, but if you weren't watching a whole lot of TV, you didn't know all that much. And then I remember going Fridays, picking up the newspaper off the table at home and opening it up and going to the movies, and you would see some of those posters in smaller form. I would cut those out of the newspaper sometimes if it was cool enough. Then I would take it and maybe try to trace it. Used to be a big tracer. Maybe one of the reasons I can't draw now is because I got lazy off the top and never was able to do that. Those kinds of things and those feelings, all of those things just come right back to life in Stranger Things. It takes you back to a simpler time. You can totally escape in this show. You don't have to think about anything in current life. You can just consider what you were in 1985, in 1984. You can just think back to your friends and you being on bikes and you and your movies and your board games and playing for me. I didn't play Dungeons and Dragons, but I played Dragon's Lair at the arcade, and Sorry and Trouble and Monopoly and Rummy and all of those games, those were part. And then, of course, video games came around at home. I had an Atari for most of my life, and then I got a Nintendo within a year of it coming out. I didn't get it right off the bat. I remember one of my close friends, my best friend at the time, got one right off the bat and went over to his house on a Saturday and saw Super Mario Brothers for the first time. And just could not believe what I was looking at, because I had been playing Pac-Man and Missile Command and Asteroids, those three in particular, maybe more so than the others. I also had Berserk and a few others, and I remember they were given to me by people. We bought Pac-Man, we bought Asteroids, we bought Missile Command. We also bought E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which is still regarded as the worst video game of all time. I never understood it. No one else ever understood it either. First day we got it, took it to a friend's house, tried to play it for hours, could not figure it out, gave it up. Did not really ever come back to that. That was a smart move on our part. But we were playing combat and stuff like that. Seeing Super Mario Brothers changed our lives. In the same way, watching the Goonies or watching Ghostbusters, which was one of my all-time favorites as well. I remember dressing up as Peter Venkman for a church lock-in at Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church in Martinsville, Virginia, where I was christened as a child. I had my own cardboard proton pack. Again, ladies were all over me during this time. Ghostbusters gets major screen time in the second season of Stranger Things 2. And if you've seen any still shots, you've seen the Halloween costumes that Joyce makes for the kids. But all of this makes Stranger Things so inviting to me. And it's why I desperately wanted this show to be good. And it's why I was so happy when season one was entertaining and was so much fun. And I'm such even happier now to be able to report that Stranger Things 2 is more of the same and in some ways is better than the first season. With a really good conclusion, with a cast of characters that you still want to be around and hang around. And in a world in Hawkins, Indiana, where you can completely escape, just watch this thing in the dark and binge it on a big TV nice and loud with your significant other or your family or whoever it is, and you're going to have a hell of a time. And that's the best thing that you can ever say about a piece of entertainment is you're going to have a hell of a time. You're going to enjoy this. You're going to laugh at this. You might get a couple of frights out of this. There are definitely some frightening things in the second season, just as there were in the first. You're going to be able to cry, maybe, a little bit. There's some heavy drama to be found, just like there was in the first year. But you're going to be wildly entertained. And I have not mentioned this yet, but I'm going to do it now. Because I have to give credit to Kyle Dixon and Michael Stein, who are the masters behind the Stranger Things soundtrack. The Halt and Catch Fire theme and the Stranger Things theme are two themes that I will always listen to. Unless I'm doing it for screening purposes and I'm just trying to get through something quickly and the intro is just going to save me another minute if I cut it out. But that Stranger Things theme and the music that recurs during the series is awesome. And you can find the soundtrack. The Stranger Things soundtrack is available on iTunes. You can buy it. You can order it through Amazon. A lot of the songs aren't even a minute long. They're just things that you can repeat and things you hear for 20 or 30 seconds during the episode. But if you just listen to it, you can actually listen to all 36 tracks that take up 69 minutes. So again, not very long, most of these. And you can replace where they happen in the show. And even if you can't, it just takes you back to that world. I tell you to do that if you're a Stranger Things fan and you have not done this. This is cool. Like, I like to take drives sometimes and just listen to music. Just long drives. I like being in a car, grab a beverage and some peanuts or some jerky or whatever like that and head off down the road. Maybe sometimes not even knowing exactly when you're going to stop. Once you figure out, all right, I'm 50 miles away from home, I'll turn around and go the other way now. I urge you to do this at night, just one night, maybe with friends or maybe just by yourself. When you just want to be in contemplation, as our boy Hopper would put it. If you got Apple Music or if you got $10 or whatever it is, go ahead and buy that Stranger Things soundtrack. Because one, it's very, very good if you like the music from the show. Obviously, if you don't like the music from the show, then this is completely irrelevant to you. But if you like it, take a drive at night, maybe on back roads if you can. Clear sky, no rain, no danger, just you and your headlights and the Stranger Things soundtrack in darkness. And just drive around for an hour and listen to that thing from start to finish. It's a really, really cool experience. Unique because it fits what you're doing. Like what you're doing, you can think of yourself as Hopper in the SUV or Jonathan in his car or the new kids that you meet in the first episode of the second season as they roll up to Rock Me Like a Hurricane. All of it fits. But do that. Just nice and dark one night when it's quiet, not when there's football on, not when there's something else on that you have to watch, not when you have responsibilities, but just carve out an hour. If You can't carve out an hour of your life. You're too busy. Carve out 1 hour where you just listen to that in the car while you drive. Or, you know what? If you take evening runs, which a lot of folks do, I do most of my exercise in the mornings just because of my schedule. But if you, you know, you work all day and you come home and that's when you maybe take a run for 45 minutes or something, try that one night in the darkness. Make sure you're reflected so that you don't get hit by cars. Do that and make sure that the earbuds are tightly fastened or your Bose or your Beats or whatever it is that you got. And listen to Dixon and Stein's soundtrack from the first season. Now, I haven't heard the second season soundtrack except in the episodes, but I'm sure they probably either have released it or will release it. But give that a shot. I think it's going to be worth your time. So this podcast, I didn't know exactly how I was going to approach Stranger Things. I could talk about all the episodes and all the high points of the first season, but you've seen it. If you're this deep into this podcast, you've seen it. I don't need to go into those things. I can talk about some of the things that I enjoyed the most, which is what I did, some of the quotes, some of the performances. You know, I didn't mention Chris Sullivan, who dies, Benny Hammond. Had to look over to my screen there for a second. Chris Sullivan, who plays Toby on This Is Us, Benny Hammond, who dies fairly early there in the first season. Reminder again that Chris Sullivan is a really good actor. He's super in that role, even though we don't know him for all that long. But from just a mythology standpoint and the way Stranger Things is done, it's just a lot of fun. And that's kind of the word that I keep going back to. And if I'm having fun watching your effort, then you've done a good job. The Duffer Brothers have done a good job for 2 seasons worth of time now. I don't need to recap all of this in order for you right now. We'll talk more specifically about the second year, maybe next week, but certainly as I do my episode-by-episode reviews next week at Outkick.com. But I felt like if I started talking about Stranger Things, I was going to delve into my own past and go into video stores and all this. And I hope that you found that enjoyable. And I'd love to hear about yours. If you're around my age as well, you know, what was your video stores? What were the movies that you used to watch? Do you have experiences like I did, like when you rolled to your friend's house for the first time and saw a Nintendo Entertainment System for the very first time? I remember I was the first to get a Super Nintendo, one of the first in the town, because I just incessantly called around and begged my parents I need to apologize for my parents. That was a lot of money for them to spend, but it was well spent because I played Super Mario World and actually was in Nintendo power for beating that thing 6 days after it came out. Yes, again, women all over me, ladies and gentlemen. But just your memories, your nostalgia, what does this show make you think of when you watch it? Do you have friends that remind you of Lucas or Dustin or Mike or Will? Probably not of 11, but I guess perhaps, and if so, then we need to have a larger discussion, and I would, you know, love to hear more about your experiences in life. Do you have a father like Mike? Do you have a mother like Will? Do you have a brother like Jonathan? A sister like Nancy? A best friend or potentially enemy like Steve? There's so much here. There's so much meat here. Like, at times, you've got Stand By Me. At times, you got the Goonies. At times, you got a little bit of Ferris Bueller popping in. You got All the Right Moves that's actually mentioned. You've got Ghostbusters. You've got The Thing. You've got E.T. There's just so much here. But what we do have now, for sure, what we got is Stranger Things. And season 2 is epic. You're going to enjoy it, I think. Watch it this weekend if you've got time. Binge it because it is a perfect binge watch, just like the first season was. If you can do it with somebody else, you should. It's a lot of fun to experience great entertainment with someone else, being able to enjoy that with you. And I think this is a really good one. It's one you can talk about and just say, oh, I really like that, or oh, I can't stand that person, or whatever it is. But I think you'll enjoy this one if you watch it with the family. Again, like I said, if you have a kid that's younger than 10, I wouldn't let them watch it yet. But if they're 12 or 13, I would say that's about the right age. And I would probably consider watching it with them if you like it as well. I don't know that it's going to frighten a 13-year-old. Parts of it might. Or it might just make them feel uneasy. But I think watching that as a family is something you can do, because there's not a whole lot of evil there. The language, there's a little bit of language, but it's language like 80s language was. Like, you remember PG movies in the 80s, you get a little bit of language. PG-13, you get a little bit more language. R, holy cow, that's a lot of language. This ain't R. This is in the PG-13 realm at most. You're not getting F-bombs dropped in Stranger Things. So I think that you're safe. But know going in that there's frightening imagery, and there is a little bit of language. And there's some negativity, obviously. The bullies were not nice in season 1, for example, and things of that ilk. But you can do a lot worse with your kid and letting them watch Stranger Things, because it does have the right messages behind it. And it shows kids persevering and working together. And even though they're going through tough situations and sometimes having disagreements, coming back with a spit swear, for example, it clicked for me. I enjoyed it a lot. Will season 2 make my top 10 for the year? I don't know, man. There's a lot of great TV in 2017, and season 1 did make my top 10. It made my honorable mention. I say I don't know, which is a pretty big compliment, because that means it's at least something that I would think about, including. I don't think it will make it, quite frankly. It's a great show, a very unique experience, and the Duffer Brothers should be commended for it. Go watch it. Go tell me on Twitter what you liked, what you didn't like at JMart Outkick, or email me at jmartclone@gmail.com. Let me know about your nostalgia. Love to hear those stories. They'll remind me of other stories as well. This show's about pop culture, but it's also about our histories and our past, because nothing exists now without something that came before it, something that led to it. There's no Mindhunter without stuff like Silence of the Lambs and Zodiac and the predecessors of that kind of thing. There's certainly no Stranger Things without an amalgam of films that the Duffer Brothers not only borrowed from, but did this show in complete and utter tribute to. What we do now is informed by what we used to do. What we do tomorrow, hopefully, is better because of the lessons we've learned from both. That goes for pop culture, and it also goes for life. Food for thought. It's still morning. I got some things to do. Namely, drink some coffee and contemplate life. I'm Jason Martin. See you next week. This has been Outkick the Culture. Karen, thank you for the casserole, but I need you to leave.